Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
From the far reaches of the known universe, we are proud to present Brother Harold Muhammad, soldier, scientist, scholar. Blog Talk Radio's finest, not so mad science, on Black Hole Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, and welcome to tonight's edition of Not So Mad Science, here on the Black Hole Radio Network, with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, once again coming to you live from the city of Detroit. Just because Berry Gordy took Motown to L.A. does not mean Detroit has lost its soul. I have what I believe is an interesting array of subject matter tonight. And I pray Allah that I will get through at least fully two of them. Recently, I read an article on theweek.com, and a question was asked by Fred Nordhaus. His question is, what is the Earth's carrying capacity? So the basic question would then, for anyone who appreciates physics, one of the primary rules is that matter can neither be created nor destroyed. Thus, the weight of the Earth can be insignificantly decreased by something leaving the Earth, and instantaneously, whatever that infinitesimal amount leaving will return. So every time a plane takes off, it leaves the Earth. However, atmosphere has weight because it has a substance. So that weight of the atmosphere on the surface of the planet would need to be added to the weight of the planet. Stands to reason, the carrying capacity of the planet Earth should be able to be calculated. Well, let's take a look at a couple of things here. When we look at the substance of the planet Earth, we have to figure out, one, how much does the Earth weigh? Well, we know that the Earth has a total area of land and water of 196,940,000 square miles. It has a general circumference of 24,896 miles. We know it has a base diameter of 7,926 miles. We know that the area of the land is 57,255,000 square miles. We know that the area of the water is 139,685,000 square miles. We know the Pacific Ocean covers 68,634,000 square miles. We know the Atlantic Ocean covers 41,321,000 square miles. We know the Indian Ocean covers 29,430,000 square miles. The general relativity of all the lakes and rivers cover approximately 1 million square miles. The total coverage of hills and mountains is roughly 14 million square miles. We know that the islands are 1,910,000 square miles. Deserts cover an area of 4,861,000 square miles. We know that Mount Everest has a relative maximum height of 29,141 feet. We also know that the producible land is 29 million square miles. Knowing these things, knowing these actual facts about the general relativity of the planet itself, From this, we can calculate the weight of the Earth. And its weight, its substantive weight, will allow us to make a determination of the Earth's carrying capacity. Yes, the Earth is hit by asteroids or meteorites on a regular basis. But the size of these rocks from space outside the atmosphere of the Earth do not significantly amount to weight substantial enough to register within the overall mass of the planet. Its mass determines its carrying capacity. This is true to a point. So what is the weight of the Earth? The weight of the planetary body we call Earth is 6 sextillion tons. It is a unit followed by 21 ciphers. This is the weight in gross tonnage of the Earth, which travels at a rate of 1,037⅓ miles per hour on its axis. We know that the Earth's inner atmosphere, that sound travels at a rate of 1,120 feet per second. Again, these numbers allow us to calculate with relative precision the carrying capacity of the Earth. We know that the Earth sits at a distance of 93 million miles from the sun. And that light travels at 186,000 miles per second, takes approximately 8 minutes for light from the sun to reach the Earth. again, light being a photon, a photonic atom, so to speak, has a substantive body to it that in the enormity of the mass of the Earth, the weight of the photons on the Earth can be calculated. Again, that weight does not disturb the overall general capacity, or in this case, the gross tonnage of the overall planetary body of the Earth in its substance. Again, the Earth weighs 6 sextillion tons. So that is the overall weight of the planet. Therefore, we should be able to calculate the carrying capacity of the sun, excuse me, of the planet Earth, as asked by Mr. Ted Norhaus. He said in his writing, in a recent Nature sustainability paper, that a team of scientists concluded that the Earth can sustain at most only 7 billion people at subsistence levels of consumption. Thus, that in the month of June of this year, the Earth was at 7.6 billion people. 0.6 billion, or 600 million people beyond the subsistence level of the mass and size of the Earth. He says that achieving high life satisfaction for everyone, however, would transgress the Earth's biophysical boundaries, leading to ecological collapse. Well, despite its seeming scientific precision, the claim is old, not new. The latest iterations of the long-standing assertion that our population and consumption might soon exceed the Earth's fixed carrying capacity. Again, when we look upon the actual facts, the producing land of the Earth is 29 million square miles, of which the water of the Earth, as in this particular instance, the lakes and rivers which would provide the aeration with water for the producing land, is only 1 million square miles of clean water for the producing land. Well, let's take a look at something now. Let's continue. He stated that the latest iteration of the long-standing assertion that our population and consumption might soon exceed the Earth's fixed carrying capacity. Well, the concept tellingly owes its origin to 19th century shipping, referring to the payload capacity of steamships. It jumps from the inanimate to the terrestrial at the end of the 19th century. describing the maximum number of livestock or wild game that grassland and rangeland ecosystems could sustain. Applied to ecology, that concept is problematic. Cargo doesn't multiply of its own volition, nor can the capacity of an ecosystem be determined from an engineer's drawing. Nonetheless, environmental scientists have, for decades, applied the concept to human societies with a claimed precision that belies its nebulous nature. And note the word that was used here, nebulous nature. And for those who do not know, I'm going to give you a definition of the word nebulous, N-E-B. U-L-O-U-S, which has a meaning, basically, in the form of a cloud or haze or hazy. It also means a concept or an idea that is unclear, vague, or ill-defined. Nebulous. So the concept that this idea can be applied to human societies with a claimed precision is nebulous, very vague, very hazy. It was the ecologist William Vogt, V-O-G-T, who was the first to do so in the 1940s. He predicted that overuse of agricultural land would lead to soil depletion and then catastrophe. It was then in the late 1960s and quite possibly the early 70s that Paul Ehrlich focused his attention on food production. And the Club of Rome on material resources, while later day environmentalists and activists have focused more on the effects that pollution and habit deconstruction will have on the Earth's systems, that human well-being depends completely on. But all of them hold the same, what Mr. Nordhaus states. He states that their viewpoint is a neo-Malthusian view of human fertility and consumption. It was from the 18th century arguments of Reverend Thomas Robert Malthus. Onwards, prophets of environmental doom. Who imagined that in response to abundance, humans would respond with more children, and more consumption. Like protozoa or fruit flies, we keep breeding and keeping consumption until the resources that allow continuing growth are exhausted. Essentially, man's greed. But I'll be specific. Made man's greed. In reality, brothers and sisters, human fertility, and consumption work nothing like this. Affluence and modernization bring falling, not rising, fertility rates. As our material consumption improves, we have fewer children, not more. The explosion of human population over the past 200 years has not been a result of rising fertility rates, but rather falling mortality rates. With better public health, nutrition, physical infrastructure, and public safety, we live much longer. Today, in the U.S., Europe, Japan, and much of what is called Latin America, even parts of India, fertility rates have dropped below the ability to replace the population, which means the average number of children born per woman is below 2. Much of the rest of the world will follow suit over the next few decades. Let me say this again. In Europe, the United States, Japan, these areas are considered the modernized societies. Their fertility rates are below replacement levels, which means modern man has lost the ability to produce enough children to sustain their existence. They're dying far faster than they're having children. And not enough children are being born to meet the demand to maintain positive population growth. Or in this case, the word I'm looking for is static population sustainability. So population is not at a zero population growth, it is at a negative population growth, beyond the ability to survive. As a result, most demographers project that human population will peak and begin a slow decline, in some cases before the end of this century. Well, these demographers, some of them, for the most part, I should say the majority of them, are behind the statistical numbers which represent the population. The United States, whites, have reached a negative population growth. They are beyond the ability to sustain their existence. Black Americans are at a positive population growth. Spanish-speaking Americans are at a positive population growth. Seems as fast as you kill them, we keep making them. Native Americans, so-called Indians, are still at a positive population growth. However, it is white Americans who, and Asian Americans, Indian, or those from India, Pakistan, in that area, are at negative population growth. They're dying faster than their population can be replaced. For this reason, today's warning of impending ecological collapse, mostly focusing on rising consumption, not population growth, As many now acknowledge, our social biology might not function like protozoa, but capitalism does. Capitalism cannot survive without endless growth of material consumption. There is no particular well-established basis for this claim, and plenty of evidence to the contrary. The long-term trend in market economies has been towards slower and less resource invention, or I should say, less resource-intensive growth. Growth in per capita consumption rises dramatically as people transition from rural agrarian economies to modern ecological economies. But then it tails off. Today, Western Europe and the U.S. struggle to maintain 2% annual growth. The consumption of affluent economy changes as well. Manufacturing once accounted for 20% or more of economic output and employment in most developed economies. Today, it is as low as 10% in some, with the vast majority of economic output coming from knowledge and service sectors with significantly lower material and energy intensities. We will continue, but we're going to take a brief, and I mean very brief, commercial break. And then we'll be right back. This is Not So Mad Science with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. We're going to have a little Ella Fitzgerald and her Funny Valentine.
Funny Valentine, right?
Ooh.
Thank you.
you.
Welcome back, welcome back. This is Not So Mad Science with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. We're talking about the carrying capacity of the Earth. For decades, each increment of economic growth in developed economies has brought lower resources and energy use than the last. That's because demand for material goods and services saturates. Few of us need or want to consume more than 3,000 calories or so a day to live in a 5,000 square foot house. Many Americans prefer to drive SUVs, but there is little interest in hauling children to soccer practice in a semi-truck. The appetite for material goods might be prodigious, but there is a limit to them. Even so, that doesn't necessarily mean we won't exceed the planet's carrying capacity. Some environmental scientists claim that we have already surpassed the Earth's carrying capacity. But this view is deeply ahistorical. Now, I want you to take note. The word ahistorical, it's an actual word. And I'm going to give you a definition. And I'm going to spell it first. Ahistorical, A-H-I-S. T-O-R-I-C-A-L, ahistorical, not a-historical, but ahistorical, means lacking historical perspective or context. This view is deeply ahistorical. There is no historical perspective or context to place that in, assuming carrying capacity to be a static number. In fact, we have been engineering our environment to more productivity and productively serve the needs for tens of millennia. We cleared forests for grasslands and agriculture. We selected and bred plants and animals that were more nutritious, fertile, and abundant. But specifically, these technological advances are particularly good for the environment. It took six times as much farmland to feed a single person 9,000 years ago, what is considered the dawn of the Neolithic Revolution, than it does today. Even as almost all of us eat much richer diets, what the paleoarchaeological record strongly suggests is that the carrying capacity is not fixed. It is many orders of magnitude greater than it was when we began our journey on this planet. There is no particular reason to think that we won't be able to continue to raise carrying capacity any further. Nuclear and solar energy are both clearly capable of providing large quantities of energy for large numbers of people without producing more carbon emissions. Modern intensive agricultural systems are similarly capable of meeting the dietary needs of many more people. How do we know? It was the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad who wrote that wonderkind of idea and spirituality called How to Eat to Live, Book 1 and 2. A planet with a lot more chickens, corn, and nuclear power is not the ideal that many wish for, but it would clearly be capable of supporting a lot more people consuming a lot more stuff for a very long time. Such a future, however, is anathema. Another word to add to your vocabulary. Anathema. What does anathema mean? I know I'm throwing words out here, so I'm going to give you, or should I say anathema? The meaning is something or someone that one vehemently dislikes. It is also a formal curse by a pope or a council of the church, which means they're excommunicating a person or denouncing a particular doctrine. Literally, it means a strong curse, anathema. So, such a future, however, is anathema, something someone dislikes vehemently. To many proponents of planetary limits, suggesting hubris of the highest order. But if it is, it is at least born of optimism, of the conviction that with wisdom and ingenuity, made man can continue to thrive. Demand to restrict human societies to planetary limits, which environmental scientists and advocates claim to know prospectively, suggests something much darker. Viewing human beings in the same way that we view single-cell organisms or insects, risk treating them that way. Malthus argued against poor laws in the belief that they only incentivize the poor to reproduce. Early argued against food aid for poor countries for similar reasons, and inspired population control measures of enormous cruelty. Think of that. They're suggesting that population control measures are born out of the idea or the concept to give aid to poor countries in terms of food stuff only encourages them to be more prolific in their production of children. There's a name for this. And And I leave that for you to do a little bit of work. I'm not going to give you the answer to everything. But we can certainly go back to the person we spoke about last week. Margaret Sanger. The mother of the abortion clinics. Planned Parenthood. Let's not get it twisted. This is the kind of things we're talking about right here. Today, demands to impose planetary boundaries globally are couched in redistributive and egalitarian rhetoric. So as to avoid any suggestion that doing so might condemn billions to deep agrarian poverty. But they say little specifically about how social engineering of such extraordinary scale would be imposed in a demographic or equitable fashion. Ultimately, one need not advocate the imposition of pseudoscientific limits on human societies to believe that many of us would be better off consuming less. Nor must one posit the collapse of human societies to worry deeply that growing human consumption might have terrible consequences for the rest of creation, which is diametric to, created man and diametrically opposite, made man. But threats of societal collapse claims that the carrying capacity is fixed and demands for sweeping restrictions on human aspirations are neither scientific nor are they just. We are not fruit flies programmed to reproduce until our population collapses, nor are we cattle whose numbers must be managed. To understand the human experience on the planet is to understand that we have remade the planet again and again and again to serve our needs and our dreams. Today, the aspiration of billions depend upon continuing to do just that. May it be so. I encourage you, one and all, as you contemplate the carrying capacity of the earth, which has a terrific weight of 6 sextillion tons with a diameter of 7,926 miles with a circumference of 24,896 miles with a total area of land and water on the planet at 196,940,000 square miles, where the water itself is 57,255,000 square miles. Correction, the land is 57,255,000 square miles, and the area of the water is 139,685,000 square miles, where the lakes and rivers have a relative square mileage of 1 million square miles, where the producing land of the planet Earth is 29 million square miles. The carrying capacity of the Earth with a terrific weight of 6 sextillion tons, the earth will produce what it needs for the population which houses on it. More producible land is being produced every day. It's a matter of time and timing. But what the hell does that mean, Brother Harold? It means this simply. Ask the Hawaiians why they grow what they grow and what they grow it out of. The Hawaiian island chain is a volcanic landmass. But over time, that mass of land that was brought up through volcanic eruption became producible for food. Well, the topography and the geography of the Hawaiian Islands is permanently changed. How do we know? Well, a volcano is still talking. Well, you think the lava has someplace else to go other than where it's already at? With every earthquake comes new land. And it is time, with the erosive nature of water and wind on that land, which reshapes the chemical nature of the new land brought up from lava rock to other things that you can then grow on it, as one land mass will be subducted under another land mass, which is adducted above, land is reshaped. Thus, where there once was none, now there is some. So the producing land, which has an area of 29 million square miles, that number is not fixed. It is not static and still. It is a fluid number. But the general mass weight of the planet will not change. It is 6 sextillion tons. You think every new baby that is born adds to the weight? No. It doesn't. Basic law of physics. Matter can neither be created nor destroyed. It is simply redistributed from one form to another. As vapor goes up, water does come down. What is the carrying capacity of the earth? The earth will respond to the need of the inhabitants, which requires what it wants to survive. This is Not So Mad Science, and I'm your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. We're going to take a brief break, and we'll be right back with our next subject. And that next subject will be, let's see if I flip through you. Nah, that one's too deep. I'll keep that one in my head. Schrodinger's cat. And as we get to Schrodinger's cat, we will begin to explain what that means. Okay, let's see what we got here. Well, I'll be darned, I reach no. It seems that we may have to forego Schrodinger's cat because my notes do not wish to agree with me So, I am aggrieved. So, we will go to the deeper commentary on, are we about to discover or uncover the dark universe? This is Not So Mad Science with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. Our brief commercial break will be filled with the delightful airwaves of a piece from Joel Ortiz and Big Daddy Kane. Kill. No, we'll be nicer than that. Kendrick Lamar with Humble.
Nobody pray for me. It been a day for me.
Hey, I remember syrup sandwiches and crime allowances. Finessing on them with some counterfeits, but now I'm counting this. Parmesan with my accountant lips, in fact I'm down in this. You say with my boobay, tastes like Kool-Aid for the analyst. Girl, I can buy a Westie world with my face stuff. I know that it's good, won't you sit it on my taste buds? I get way too busy, won't you let me do the extras? Pull up on your block and break it down, we playing Tetris.
It seems Kendrick Lamar's Humble is a little too out there for some of you, looking at some of the commentaries I've looked at. So, we're going to go with a little Marvin Gaye, who's the MJ of music, and his piece called Sexual Healing.
Strong.
Welcome back. Welcome back. This is Not So Mad Science with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. I pray that you all are enjoying the show and we're all learning something. As we learn, we grow. As we grow, we come together. As we come together, we become more powerful than an atomic bomb. It is our unity that gives us power. It is our unity that gives us strength. It is our unity that makes us the most destructive and productive force in nature, second only to God Himself. Let us all grow together. Our next subject for discussion and I think it's an interesting subject in the internet magazine called New Scientist or New Scientist Live. The question is asked, are we about to uncover the dark universe? The New Scientist staff got together and penned a joint article. And they say, and I should say not they, but it is a known fact that almost all of the universe, according to the science of today and available technology, says, and it is confirmed, is missing, or at least they've never seen it. We've never seen it directly. Will we ever know in truth what's out there? Now, there are those of us who do know, who have a system of understanding from He who it is the author and the inheritor of the wisdom of self-creation. But that's not what we're here to discuss right now. We're here to look at the available science of today's made man's thinking. What's out there? And that's the question that Catherine Haymans and Shamkur Garg will be asking at New Scientist Live. All the stuff we can see, from stars and planets to galaxies and supernovae, make up a paltry 5% of the contents of the visible and known universe. I've stated that numerous times on this program on Not So Mad Science. Over 95% of what is known, of what should be there, cannot be found. And only 5% of the visible mass and light and everything else can be found. Why can't we find the other 95%? The majority of the rest of the universe consists of this thing called dark energy. It is a mysterious force that is pulling the cosmos apart. But 27% of the universe is also known as dark matter. It is the invisible counterpart to the invisible, or I should say to ordinary matter, that adds bulk to galaxies. When it comes to pinning down dark matter, for decades. The most common candidates have been what's something known as WIMPs, weakly interacting massive particles, too heavy for us to make using particle colliders such as the CERN system. But a landmark experiment earlier this year suggests, it is not known, but it suggests that the answer might instead lie in the much lighter particles that possess a tiny electric charge. Meanwhile, others have suggested that dark matter is merely a fudge invented to account for an incomplete understanding of the workings of gravity and doesn't really exist. Something to ponder, isn't it? What we know on made man's active understanding of what's out there, we can only count for 5%. So they're asking scientists from around the world to come to the New Scientist Live Symposium in London on September 20th of this year to hear Dr. Hayman, an astrophysicist at the University of Edinburgh, explain why she thinks that a true understanding of the dark universe will require an entirely new form of physics. On September 22nd, Dr. Gog, his name is spelled G-H-A-G, Gog, who also is an astrophysicist at the University College of London, will describe how the hunt for dark matter is heating up and how we may soon even be able to produce it ourselves. In the immortal words of that great comedian, Tool Time. He said, "I don't think so, Tim." These two scientists say that New Scientist Live is an award-winning festival of ideas and discoveries. It is a four-day event, and I wish I had the ability to attend it myself, which will take place in London. The four-day event will feature more than 120 speakers giving thought-provoking talks on everything from visiting the planet Mercury to the search for extraterrestrial life. But more important, the understanding of dark matter, the understanding of dark energy, two substantives and a force of existence that cannot be accounted for. The mathematics says it's there, only we can't find it. We don't know what it is. We don't know where it is. We can only say that the ever-expanding condition of what is the known universe is still growing at a speed faster than light. Now, wait a minute. We thought that according to the general theory of relativity postulated and supposedly proven by Mr. Einstein, that nothing travels faster than light. For as you approach that terrific speed of 186,000 miles per second, that mass is gained. not lost. So anything traveling faster than light would increase in mass. Well, dear brothers and sisters, I'm going to remind you once again. There is something that we interact with every single day that is faster than light. It happens to you every day. It is something that we each as human beings do every day. It is a calculatable speed. What is that thing, Mr. Muhammad? Thought. Thought travels at the enormous speed on average of 24 billion miles per second. That means that the poor brother and sister on the corner, in the alleyways, the highways and byways, in the trap house, the flop house, the crack house, and the outhouse, bent over in their condition of disgust and debauchery from the poisons that they pumped into their systems, their mind is clicking away at the average speed of 24 billion miles per second. For those of us who suffered through the experience of the wave of heroin in the black community in the 60s, we saw the heroin addict on the corner who just shot up, bent over, body perpendicular and parallel to the ground simultaneously, bent over in an L shape, bending and looking like they're leaning and about to fall. But because of the capacity of the mind to overwhelm its condition, its physical condition, they don't fall down. Because that mind is still cracking away, even though it has been poisoned. Thought travels on average at a speed of 24 billion miles per second. So imagine how fast your thinking is when you are in your right mind and in tune. How fast do you think? Elijah Muhammad said we must be fast moving, quick thinking, right down to the modern day and time. How old is old? Depends on how slow you want to think. It's determined by what you do, not your condition. This is Not So Mad Science with your host, Brother Harold Mahoney, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. Once again, I encourage you to look into the words of Margaret Sanger and her ideas of population control. I encourage you to consider again the carrying capacity of the earth, which has a terrific weight of 6 sextillion tons. The earth will produce what we need. All we need to do is think it, and it is. How to Eat to Live, by the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad. We are the earth, and the earth is us. It will respond to what we need. Population control is not the answer. how to eat to live. Once again, as I begin to close out, this is Not So Mad Science with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network, coming to you live from the city of Detroit. If you missed the opening portions of tonight's program, I would encourage you, one and all, to reach out to me via Facebook on Black Hole Radio, where the link to tonight's program will be posted, or write me a message via email at hemdevelopmentgroup@gmail.com, or shoot me a text, 313-205-2632, or call in at any program and ask whatever question you like on any program that we've done, or give a suggestion on a program that you would like to be discussed. And if we haven't covered it, we'll cover it. We'll find the science in it and we'll deal with it. Let us all learn together. Let us all grow together. In the words of Frankie Beverly, we are one. And let us not leave out George Clinton when he said, one nation under a groove, getting down just for the funk of it. One nation, we are now on the move. Nothing can stop us now. It was Sister Sledge who sang, we are family. I got my brothers and my sisters with me, because the Honorable Elijah Muhammad told us that regardless what you call yourself, we are fighting for Islam, and we will surely win. With our Savior Allah, God, the universal King, we are fighting for our nation and called by his name. So let us rise, O ye Muslims and Christians, and fight for your own. Thank you for listening. This is Not So Mad Science with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network, leaving you with those immortal words of the late Adam Clayton Powell, Jr., senator, pastor, social warrior. Keep the faith, baby. Keep the faith. God willing, we'll talk next week. Good night.